Hello, welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a Cinelinks podcast, the podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, then you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. Since it's that time of year, I've decided to do a Halloween special. And I've got a very special guest joining me to talk all things sinister and strange. But not only that, I've invited Jessica Salafia Ward from LaughingPlace.com and Cinelinks.com to co-host because, well, she's a bit of a horror nut, so it seemed appropriate. We'll be back next time with a regular episode, but in the meantime, enjoy this special, and please, if you go trick-or-treating, be safe. Everyone, welcome to a special Halloween edition of Everything is Canon. My co-host for today's Spookfest is a contributor to laughingplace.com and is a fellow Cinelinkser. More importantly, I get the sense she dabbles in the ghostly and the ghoulish, and I have no doubt that the fact that she lives in Louisiana will come up during this conversation, and already has. Hi, Jess, how are you doing today?
Hi, everyone. I'm great. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks for having me.
Of course. You're the expert, one of the experts today. But since we are talking Halloween, we did bring in a ringer. Our guest today, who I'm going to be just referring to as a subject matter expert in the fields of the fantastical and the frightening, Jennifer Brody, a.k.a. Vera Strange, is the award-winning author of the Disney Chills book series, the 13th Continuum Trilogy, and the graphic novels Spectre Deep 6 and 200 with her creative partner, Jewel Rivera. She's a graduate of Harvard University, a film and TV producer and writer, and a creative writing teacher. She began her career in Hollywood, working on many films you've probably never heard of, like Lord of the Rings and The Golden Compass. She lives and writes in Malibu by the beach, which sounds pretty awful. Hi, Jennifer. How are you doing today?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's tough out here on the beach. It's actually been cloudy today. We got marine layer. It's a little fallish for us. It was 80 this weekend. So
you're just having a rough go. We'll hope you make it to the other side. All right.
I'm struggling. We'll see.
Today was a weird day today because the day started out with everyone talking about masturbation and then.
Yeah, that kind of came over from yesterday. I was I hadn't been in the news in a minute and I was like, what did I miss?
Right? And then,
people are losing it, yo.
it's been a weird, I haven't seen so many euphemisms for masturbating in my life. And
I never even thought it was something I'd have to think about when getting on a Zoom call.
I know. And then the people defending the action too, which is even crazier. So I was like kind of feeling like kind of down about the whole day in general. But then just before we came on here, Ava DuVernay replied to one of my tweets.
Shut up. That's amazing.
And Ava is one of those weird people. She's one of my, whenever one asks you, who's your most famous follower, that's who I say. Ava DuVernay follows me. I don't know why, but she just does. And I'm always.
Because rad, and she's rad.
She's definitely rad. That's like my queen right there. And
I know. I think she totally got robbed of Oscar nominations. Oh, I love Selma. Big time robbed.
I'm just have that crazy fear that one day she's gonna look at her followers list and be like, "Who's this idiot gone?" And I'm just gonna be like, "No!" Especially with the new. Anyways, so it just happened before we started talking. So, do you guys have anybody on your list, like somebody super famous? That, like, if someone was to ask you who's your most famous follower, do you have any?
Oh, I was saying that it's a lot of authors who are my friends, especially sci-fi fantasy folks or. Young adult, YA author people who I've been friends with a long time. So I don't know if Leigh Bardugo means anything to anyone or Jonathan Mayberry or Peter Kleins or my old boss, Mark Wardeski, who did Lord of the Rings. I tend to work a lot with behind the scenes or write books. I do know, I'm really close to Chevy Chase and the Chevy Chase family. So, but Chevy's not really on social media. So it's if you want to talk to Chevy, it's going to be through his wife or his daughters.
How'd you make that connection?
I actually lived next door to them for a long time when he got Community and booked that. I was just sort of I think my next door neighbor is Chevy Chase now.
Okay. Isn't that?
And then we became close friends. Yeah, I love the family.
Were you next to them during the whole like community fallout when the show ended?
Oh, I have been through a lot with the family. They're kind of like my family. Yeah, the whole, all the Dan Harmon stuff. Yeah, yeah. I mean, people think some of it's more dramatic than it is.
Sure.
I love Chevy. I think he's a genius. Right, absolutely amazing. You know, Dan's a handful too.
I know.
Love him too, like he, you know, let's just be frank that was not a one-sided situation.
Right. No, I don't. Yeah, for sure. I'm not even sure if anybody even thinks that. Not anymore, anyways. I think especially, you know, it's because the longer, especially like his Dan's podcast went on, the more he revealed about himself. And I think people started to understand that he's a handful, right? So.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the whole voicemail debacle, I just thought that the voicemail was hilarious.
Yeah.
I was laughing with the family about it the next day because it was pretty funny. And I thought it was kind of lame that he leaked it. It was a private thing. It was
I don't disagree with you at all.
But yeah, no, they're, you know, they're awesome. I've worked on so many film projects and stuff. Yeah. There are a lot of people I know. But like I said, I don't spend a ton of time on social media personally, but it's more there for my readers to find me.
Sure. Jess, anybody, any famous?
Yeah, what about you? Y'all are famous.
Sure. No, I mean, I'm not really big on like Twitter. I try to boost my Twitter presence just because that's where everyone sort of seems to be or, you know, seems to kind of trek through more frequently than, you know, Facebook or Instagram. But I also have like a few authors and, Disney animators who are, you know, kind of godlike to me.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying, like similar to you, Jess. Like the people that I'm like obsessive about, I don't know if someone else would be like, oh my God, you know?
Right, exactly. Like I know I've had some, you know, great chats on Facebook with Mike Peraza, and, you know, he's been working for Disney for a long time. He, you know, did a lot of the key animations on films like The Little Mermaid and even outside of Disney like Anastasia, which I just find fascinating. And, you know, he's constantly sharing his work for avid followers. Like you said, Jennifer, I'm not sure if they're like, yeah, super famous to other people and what fame is measured by for the purposes of this discussion.
Well, yeah, and we're living in this interesting time where, and then there's like the influencers, right, who really have the big followers. And I actually know a lot of those guys. It's really funny. I don't know. My world intersects a lot with like the Hype House people and the others, and it's so funny, but they're just in this TikTok, this very specific world, you know. I don't know if that counts, but
yeah, no, I think that definitely counts in a way that's like, oh, you know, I follow them, and maybe this sort of niche clique of people might know who that is, but to the outside world, you know, we won't know. And same, like you were saying, you've done a lot of behind the scenes stuff, and you know, you worked with your boss on like Lord of the Rings and Golden Compass, and you know, I'm sure you worked with all these incredible people because we all know those films, but we mightn't know the specific players that you were involved with. So tricky question, Steve.
Tricky. Yeah, it's tricky. Like I know a lot of very famous musicians, but I don't know that they're really on Twitter much, you know.
I really just want to be able to say in a public space that Ava DuVernay follows me, all right?
So. No, that's completely legit. I mean, I think, you know, hey, and her Twitter feed is really interesting, you know, and I find everybody can go either way. Look at JK Rowling lately. Oh my gosh.
Oh no. Well, it's the thing too with social media is even if you delete it, it's out there, right? So you got to be real careful these days. And,
yeah, and I'm like a giant Harry Potter fan, and I just, I wish I didn't know these things about her. Like, I just almost don't want to know this much.
How do you feel about that? Okay, that's an interesting question, because, I mean, you've spent some time with, like, you know, working for the Weinstein Company and stuff. What's your position? I want to ask you.
Yeah, no, I produced a film for Harvey. Oh.
No.
Yeah, and, I work for all the bad people in Hollywood. Which, so yeah, I mean, my first job was for Michael Bay.
I think, and I'm not going to ask you anything personal or specific, but just in the sense that, like, because I remember I read a poll one time, and I think it was in the high 60 percentile where people who were like going to continue to enjoy that person's work, you know, despite their actions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complicated question. A friend of mine just had to remove a lead actor from a film that he's making. We're working on a different project together because of some Me Too stuff. And in this case, it didn't really bother me based on this individual. He's a comedian. I think a lot of comedians are getting hit. I'm like, yeah, they're crazy. 20 years ago, he did some crazy things, you know?
Right.
Who's surprised? This was a long time ago. It's not definitely on the Harvey level of anything, but it was bad for publicity and bad for sales. So I think it's a really complicated question. In terms of J.K. Rowling, I kind of wish I didn't know these things about her. Yeah. I sort of want to divorce the work. I mean, the original Harry Potter series is what I really care about anyway, and I kind of want to take that away from this. Her new work, I'm not going to read probably. I mean, I think that's where it is. I mean, I'm a huge Ender's Game fan, and Orson Scott Card is a similarly you know, homophobic, transphobic individual. I actually haven't met him. But Ender's Game is a beautiful, sensitive book. So I kind of want to take that away. I mean, this is like the conversation about H.P. Lovecraft, right? My mentor, Victor Laval, I was hanging out with him and Marlon James when we came up with the idea of rewriting Lovecraft to take out the racist stuff. And he went off and did it and wrote Ballad of Black Tom and won the Shirley Jackson Award. And Victor is amazing. And I remember Marlon like lost it. He was like, you actually did it. You actually went off and did this thing. But we talked about it because you can't really write horror without knowing Lovecraft. And obviously Lovecraft Country is a big show right now. But, you know, any author you read from a certain amount of time ago probably was sexist, probably was racist, right? You know, do we think Hemingway was a nice person?
I don't think anyone thinks Hemingway was a nice person.
Yeah, and his life ended pretty tragically and horribly. So, but I mean, do we still read and enjoy Hemingway? I mean, I would say yes. He's not my favorite author, but I'm not going to cancel his literature. And I sort of feel that way about J.K. Rowling. Do I want to read the stuff going forward? Probably not. You know, turn me off.
That seems to be the general consensus, I think, is that like people will keep in, you know, maybe and watch the old films now and again and reread the books, but it stops here. Like the consumer part of it stops here. Yeah.
Yeah. That's sort of how I feel. And I think that the universe really largely belongs to the fandom now. I mean, I feel the same way to a degree about Star Wars. It's not just George Lucas anymore, right? There's a huge fandom and a huge swath of people that are now creating Star Wars content. And so to a degree, and I feel this way, even when I write and finish a book and you send it off to the world, it almost doesn't belong to you anymore.
No,
you
know, that's
it belongs
that's,
to the world and the readers, and different readers are interpreted different ways. And by the way, some people aren't going to like your stuff. Some people are going to love it and be obsessed with it. You know, and that's okay too.
That's
and
why
nobody's
I talk
necessarily wrong.
Yeah, that's why I talk a lot about how I think art is processed. Because once it's done, it's a book. It could be anything, right? A paperweight or used for anything. But the process is, I think, what the art is when the art comes out of somebody. Just a sort of final pin in it too. Like the Weinstein thing is the best example for me because the jury's out on him, obviously, right? Like there's literally, no one's disputing how horrible the things he's did.
Oh, but, yeah, he's going to prison. I mean, but what he did was so beyond the beyond.
Right, right. But his name in some fashion is attached to untold number of films. So,
unreal how much stuff they did.
Right. And like, I think there was another poll at some point, somebody said the top three most, at that point, most thanked people in awards was God, Steven Spielberg, and Harvey Weinstein. So he's a good example to use because are you going to stop watching all the films he played a part in?
Their names are on Lord of the Rings. I mean, they originally financed that. And I remember going into this meeting with my book series, 13th Continuum, we're in the midst of, where it's packaged for television and we're pitching it and it's pretty high level, the people who are involved. And the first time I think I went into the meeting with the big producers and this giant house in the Palisades, I was talking to one of them who had sold Lord of the Rings and Alien and Star Wars and Star Trek. And he was like, we were talking about, I was like, do you think the Weinsteins are mad they gave up Lord of the Rings? And from across the room, the other really big producer who used to head a studio just yells, they're all going to jail. And I was like, oh my God, this is like, it's so weird because they were such an institution for so long, you know? But I do think that's a different situation. You know, I think it's important to have perspective on it, you know, and to look at these different situations and not just group everyone into one category.
Agreed. Jess, where are you on that? Are you able to still enjoy an artist's work, even if it turns out they're a Nazi or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things.
I do agree. It's I don't want to say case by case, but it's difficult.
I think like what Jennifer said, you know, like on the face of it, everyone kind of grapples with that. Like, what am I supporting? You know, I need to patronize like these sorts of people who you know, at a certain point, it's no longer about differing opinions. It's about like human rights and what you think other people are entitled to. And I think that's where the real kind of problem lies. But to what Jennifer said, I think she made a great point that, you know, once an artist creates something, it goes out into the world and it belongs to the fans. And, and at that point, I think the work sort of transforms and takes on this role of like, well, what does the work mean to you? And what sort of nostalgia and memories are attached to, you know, your experience, you know, each individual's experience with the work. And I think that's more sort of, and I don't know, you know, some people, you know, someone might turn around and say, oh, well, Jess, that's a great justification for you, you know, continuing to patronize these people. But honestly, I think that's the crux of it, because otherwise you're sort of, you're punishing yourself for foregoing these things that you, you know, may have grown up with. And I think the sort of the real kind of turning point for those things are, like you said, from a commercial perspective going forward, maybe it's not something that you'll pursue.
Yeah, that you want to continue to patronize. I think that's right. I did sign the petition against her because I do agree strongly about the human rights elements of that. But I mean, again, it does remind me of the conversation I had with Marlon James and Victor Laval, who are both writers of color, about H.P. Lovecraft. And Victor said, you know, he grew up reading Lovecraft. Victor writes horror, largely. I mean, his book, The Changeling, won the World Fantasy Award. It's largely a very dark fairy tale. And he said he didn't, you know, the racist stuff, which is totally on the page, by the way, in the stories, like the N-word and stuff, went totally over his head, right, as a kid reading this. And then he revisited it in college and was kind of horrified by this thing that he loved as a child, right? Mm-hmm. Where he didn't notice these elements that are actually different from, I mean, in Harry Potter, it's not really on the page. This actually is, you know, and then grappling with that as an adult, like, what did this mean to me? What does it mean to me now? And like I said, he turned that into his own work, you know, and his own art, which I thought was a really neat response.
There was a really good, FyeCon was last weekend, and there was a really great Lovecraft panel, and they talked about the difference between, you know, reclamation and revisionist history, and you know, how far do we take it until we get to that line where we don't want to propagate so much, but at least still we got to turn a page at some point too, right? Really great discussion. Anyone up there, I recommend looking that panel up if you get a chance. I know it's in their archives.
Sounds like a great panel. And I mean, I think this, my whole thing is I kind of hate cancel culture because it doesn't really advance a conversation. And I think the benefit of these things is learning from mistakes and having teachable moments and inspiring sophisticated conversation, because these issues are complex, you know?
That's right.
For sure. But the issue with cancel culture is a tricky one too, because what's happening on social media is not the same or reflective of what's happening in the industry. You would know that better than I would, for sure.
But that's correct.
Yeah. So I mean, that's another thing too. We got to get away from even that, the way we describe that situation. But enough of that. We're here to talk about Halloween, for Christ's sakes.
Let's talk about fun things, exciting fun things, scary things.
And I, one of the things, you know, there's, you know, you've talked to Jess a couple times, you know, this year, and you've been asked so many of these questions so many times. So I don't really want to go over too much of this one, but this one was interesting to me only because I just read this Forbes interview with you, and you had a really, really, really great line. I thought it was really beautiful. It was talking about your partner, your creative partner. So, quote, "With Jules, we have a partnership and a collaboration. She makes my work better. I make her work better. We have different skill sets. I'm really strong on story and structure. She's an artist and a super visual, the way she sees things," end quote. I thought just a really beautiful way to describe a relationship, a working relationship. And I just thought, how has this year, you know, with all the stuff that's been going on with the pandemic and everything else, how has this been for you creatively with Jules, and how have you guys met? Because you've been working all year, so how's it been?
Yeah, I mean, Jules, I mean, the way she's my work wife. We really call each other work wives. Like, we talk intensively all the time through text. I do see her in person. She is one of the people who I do still see right now. She loves to surf, so she'll come to the beach and surf, and we'll hang out. We did finish 200. It's done. It's delivered. So we're not having to be as intensively together. When we were really doing that process, we would meet in person about once a week. I used to have a loft in downtown LA, and I would also work out of the Ace Hotel, where I ran kind of a creative incubator, and I would have just different creatives drop in. Ha, pre-pandemic days, you know, musicians, writers, actors, whoever, and a lot of cool stuff came out of that process. She just landed a huge gig. The New York Times wrote about her, where she's writing the syndicated comic Mark Trail now. She took over. The person who was writing it before got himself in trouble on Twitter for being sexist and other things and got himself fired. And she was hired to fill his shoes. And I think what she's doing with Mark Trail is really exciting and revolutionary. And she is, I think, only the second Latina to have a syndicated comic. She's just such a massive talent. And I know that she's going to continue to do really phenomenal things. We're excited about 200. It's coming out in February. We already have a film director attached, Jen McGowan, who's super talented. And that's kind of what I do. I love putting projects together and then putting cool people who I admire or have been watching their careers develop and starting to collaborate. I'm actually working on a new film project right now just for fun because I like motorcycle racing and I just put a filmmaker on it. And I'm co-writing a script with this director who's amazing. So I don't know. I'm always just getting myself into random things for fun. But a lot of the stuff I do is very collaborative. The Disney Chill series is very collaborative with working with my Disney team, and they're all amazing. And I think, again, I like having people in my corner that help make my work better. This week I'm writing a book proposal for a new graphic novel with an artist that I've watched for 2 years and did a program with who's finally available. So I love that. I love having other influences come in to move my work. And then obviously when we start to get into like stuff like television, I mean, I have a huge team trying to make 13th Continuum, including a showrunner and a younger writer. So it takes a village, kind of, you know, and I love that. Oh, you know, and then there's
not kind of, absolutely it does. Yeah.
You're publishing in the world, I mean, other authors become kind of part of your tribe. Like, that's why Serena Valentino has just been amazing in welcoming me into the Disney Villains family. We talked about Serena, like other authors I know who have either mentored me, like Victor Laval, like Jonathan Mayberry, or, you know, been in my corner or encouraged me, or even it's stuff like I'm on deadline and I'm messaging Jonathan because we both, I think, wrote 4 books this year. Like, we're crazy, you know, and we'll be like doing writing sprints together on Facebook, you know.
You feel like you have the best job in the world, but also a really hard, like high pressure job. And I was talking to Steve about this previously, and I'm interested to get your take on it. You know, you've got all these different projects in all these different forums, and yet they're all predominantly, you know, creative. How do you balance like creativity with, you know, with really strict deadlines that, you know, they're just... that's what they are. It's not about like you have this freedom and this time to go and do what you want and come back to us when your muse shows up and you're suddenly inspired. It's like, you know, this is the deadline. How do you manage that with so many projects up in the air?
I think it's a complex question. I do think a lot of creatives really struggle when their work shifts from being the, what I'm going to call aspiring, into the working author, working, you could put whatever you want in that box, which means you're grappling with contracts and, you know, agents and deadlines and expectations. And that includes readers, you know, reader expectations, especially when you're writing a series. This is the second time I've done a series, and that becomes something that's added pressure. For me, very purely, I love creating weird stories. Like, it's so what I love is just that pure creativity. The upside of deadlines is that you're going to have another book. The downside is that it's a little bit soul crushing sometimes. When I'm drafting, it is get up and write a chapter a day, especially on Disney. But if I'm in the flow of the story and really enjoying it, and I just delivered the 5th book in Disney Chills, and I absolutely loved this book and I loved writing it, and I was actually really sad when I sent it off, although I'm sure it's coming back to me for revisions, but I just had such a good time with my characters and my story. And the reason I keep doing all these other projects, including the motorcycle one, is just like, it's really fun for me. Like, I love it and I love making cool stuff. In terms of balancing, I think I have a pretty good perspective. I definitely take time off after delivering the Disney book. I definitely, for like about the last week or two, have been, for me, vegging a lot and just like, you know, not writing anything specifically that's like intensive and just focusing on other elements of the work. And I think also building good teams around me, which includes like my agent teams, my manager is great. And just having good collaborators on projects that can help shoulder that, which is why I like to co-write or collaborate a lot, because it's not just me. you know, I have other people that are handling it or moving the ball forward. That takes some of the pressure off of just it being me. So I personally would be excited to get into production and sell some film and television projects. I do have a whole slate, but it's COVID's definitely been a factor for that, with production opening and shutting down and all the pitches are Zoom. So it's definitely a very unusual situation, and unusual situation to publish into, of course. You know, this is not the normal way you would have a book come out and what you would do to promote it.
Speaking of books that you've got out to promote, you mentioned quickly there, you're here to talk about a little bit about Disney Chills. So Disney Chills, you know, they're describing it, the promotional language is Disney meets Goosebumps. The series sees famous Disney villains terrorizing new characters in new ways. So it's a 5-book series. Two are out already, Part of Your Nightmare and Fiends on the Other Side. Those two, the first one looks at the villain is Ursula, and in Fiends on the Other Side, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, you're looking at Dr. Valtier. I can't even
say Facilier.
I can never say his name right. The Shadow Man, basically.
Let's call him the Shadow Man.
Yeah.
Don't make a deal with the Shadow Man.
The third book, second start of the fright, is Captain Hook. Be Careful What You Wish For is the fourth book, which looks at the amazing Cruella de Vil. You want to tell us who the villain is from the fifth book?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say. I mean, I think it'll probably go up soon because all the marketing and promotion. I just got the plan is starting. So book 4, which is Cruella de Vil, goes with the new 101 Dalmatians movie, which I'm going to go on a limb and guess might just go to Disney Plus. I don't know. It seems like they're putting all their content right now onto Disney Plus. But Emma Stone plays Cruella, so that book's paired with that. And the fifth book I wrote, there are other villains I wanted to do, although I was super happy to do this one. But as soon as they greenlit the movie, I knew they were going to ask me to do this one. So it goes with another movie, actually, that's coming right after 101 Dalmatians. So if you know anything about what Disney's doing next, then you might be able to guess who I wrote. He's also a total fan favorite. It's a he.
We'll figure that one off air.
I bet it'll go live soon. It's been fun. I mean, Disney really just put so much behind the series, because I think the original deal was 3 books, and I delivered Fiends, and they went ahead and extended it to 5 way before we'd even published, which I'd never heard of 5 books that far out of publication. So Disney's just been amazing. I can announce that the first 3, I think, are going to audiobook production. So those will be out next year. They're out in France. Actually, the Captain Hook book's already out in the UK, interestingly. I just got some of the foreign editions. Yeah, it's just wild. Yeah, so it's cool. I hope to write more, actually, because there's just so many villains I haven't done that I would love to do.
So these are basically, I know Jess will talk more about this, but these are a Be Careful What You Wish For type of idea, right? That the endings aren't happy.
No, so it's definitely unhappily ever after. That was a big thing from the beginning of the series. Disney's essentially paying me to scare children, which is awesome. Very happy with my life choices. Actually, the original editor that hired me, when he hired me, he was like, I couldn't have imagined anyone else doing this series. And I was like, I think that's a compliment, isn't it? Like, but I've been impressed by how dark they've actually let me go, because I do write horror for adults, and I'm a big horror buff. I've worked on a lot of like movies. The first film projects I worked on besides Donnie Darko, which actually is quite dark now that I think about it, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the prequel, and I developed Leatherface's backstory. I worked on Freddy versus Jason. I love Clive Barker. So this is the kind of stuff I love doing, and Disney really let me go pretty dark with the series, and I think the endings have been a little shocking for people, a lot of readers. And sometimes I've seen some reviews where they're like, I liked it till the end, but I was thinking it might not be this, what? And then the second, and they're like, is this going to be the whole series? And now I think with Fiends, they're like, oh, wow, okay. But it's been fun collaborating with them to craft the whole tone of this brand and series for Disney, which is Disney Chills, and to really set it in motion with them. And I think that, I don't know, the first book, Part of Your Nightmare, is sitting very happily with 5 stars on Amazon. So it seems that the reception has been really nice, which is exciting to see that fans are really embracing it. And it is a lot of middle grade readers, which is exciting. And we like that it reaches a lot of reluctant readers. I hear from a lot of parents that, oh, my kid had stopped loving reading. School had really kind of you know, taken it out of them, and then they found your series and suddenly they're back into reading again. So that's really exciting, just getting kids reading, especially right now, and engaging them right now. And it's a lot of adults, because as you guys know, obviously Disney has huge fandom. And so a lot of adults seem to be reading the series as well and liking it, which is cool.
What is it about the teenage condition that makes these types of sort of twisted fables like so ripe for storytelling? It's just the sheer fact of they're in that phase in their life where they're so susceptible to these types of things, or?
This is the first time I've written middle grade specifically. My Continuum trilogy is technically young adult, but very crossover because it's a multiple point of view kind of epic story. I love writing middle grade. For me, it's such a complex time. It's definitely they're coming of age stories. If you think back to middle grade, it's all about the angst, you know, you just lean into the angst, which I do. And I try to write very strong character lines and very strong character relationships is really important to me in voice. And to write very fully fleshed out characters and exploring complex situations. I mean, the books on the surface are these books about villains, but thematically they're always about something much deeper, which I pull from usually the original film. And they're real scenarios that are hopefully very relatable. I mean, in Fiends on the Other Side, it's about a brother who feels like he's in the shadow of his twin brother who is more popular, more athletic, you know, and I think that that is a very relatable situation, you know, sibling rivalry, sibling jealousy, you know, wishing that just for a moment you could have that life, that grass is greener. But of course, you know, in horror, there's always a transgression, you know, where a character does something they're not supposed to do that invites in the horror and we learn a lesson. So I think, you know, that goes all the way back to the Grimm fairy tales and probably before, and to storytelling that, you know, and that is an element of horror. I think coming of age is a specifically interesting time to write because characters are open to influences and are open and they're figuring out who they are and learning about the world they really live in. So it makes it really fun. And I do think historically a lot of horror movies, you're going to see a lot of teens, you know, that tends to be a trope that we see and explore pretty in-depthly. And I also just grew up reading Goosebumps. I was like such a fan. So wanted to bring a new series to life that was kind of like Goosebumps.
Absolutely. There's definitely something going on right now with Disney and their eagerness to get their villains out there, right? I mean, this series, Serena's villain series, City of Villains comes out in a couple months, and then all the great, you know, films we've seen recently. It's a bit of a renaissance, isn't it, for Disney villains anyways?
Well, they have the best in the business. Like, let's just be frank. Like, Disney has the best IP in the business, and which, especially when you throw in Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars, and then their own IP, and they absolutely, in my mind, have the best villains. Like, I can't think of another brand or company that has as good a villain IP. You know, I don't even think Marvel does. I mean, someone's going to hate me for saying that. But, you know, when we stack up, I mean,
You own everything, you're going to have all
the best. You're going to have all the best. So, like, I mean, I think stories are really only as strong as the villains.
Yeah.
Your protagonist is only as strong as the antagonist. This is something I love in Star Wars, the originals, not the new ones, is that they crafted such great antagonists. You know, and it really is about Darth Vader and Anakin Skywalker and the Emperor and their storylines, you know, and Disney's the same, you know, Ursula, she's so amazing, you know, and their movies were genuinely scary. When I was a kid and I saw Disney, like, they terrified me. Even just Bambi scared the heck out of me. Well, that was the first one I saw.
Well, one of the fun things we're going to do today is I've asked you both to come with your three scariest, you know, films or whatever. And one of them for me is a Disney film. So we'll get to that in 1 second.
Ooh. Jess, I do have a Disney movie that terrified me as a kid.
Jess, you're a huge fan of the villain series, right? Serena's series. I know that.
I am. I do love the villains. And yeah, just listening to you guys chat about this now, I, you know, they have always been engaging and ripe for the taking. So it is particularly interesting that they're striking so much commercial and even more widespread interest at this time. So it's very cool.
Also too, you know, listening, Jennifer, I know even like Spectre Deep Six is paranormal-ish, right? Very. So.
Oh yeah, it's definitely.
This is your wheelhouse, it seems like to me. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, especially supernatural horror is totally my jam. I absolutely love it. And I tend to have this inverse reaction where actually when something gets really dark and scary, I just get excited.
Okay.
There are very few things that actually terrify me. And if something actually gets under my skin, I'm like mad props because it takes so much to really get me. So, yeah.
Yeah, but movies scare you then.
Yeah, so, and yeah, of course, listening to Nine Inch Nails enough will definitely...
I know, I love Trent. I actually used to hang out with him back in the day.
His musical scoring is incredible.
Well, that's part of the intersection of when I first met Trent. I wanted him to start scoring movies, actually, because he was my favorite band growing up, and I'd moved to LA, and I met him at a concert after the Hollywood Bowl, and no one knew he was back in LA. Everyone thought he was still in New Orleans, and I just ended up having this time period where I spent time with Trent, and I got to go in the studio and like listen to music when he was like working, and that was the whole thing I was talking to him about. It was before Fincher got him to do it. I think they ended up leaving the studio, but I was just working on him. Would you do this? Would you score a movie? And, you know,
Atticus too is great, and together they're great. And
I mean, it was always, even this was the With Teeth era, it was always Atticus and Trent in the studio together. I met Atticus as well. Yeah, they're amazing, and I would love to work with them on a project in the future. They're just super pricey now because, you know, they're all
when you win Oscars, that does that.
I know, the first time he did it won an Oscar, but I love that. I got Marilyn Manson to do the teaser music for us for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Would love to work with Sean Crahan from Slipknot Clown on something. He was involved in a project I had. I love these guys. I think they're so talented. My favorite right now is Machine Gun Kelly. I want to put him in something and have him score something for me.
Right on. That'd be great.
He's amazing.
Especially people like Marilyn and Trent and Atticus.
Yeah.
Like they're not just, you know, they're obviously more than rock stars. They're creative to the point where whether they were doing music or not, they'd be doing something. They're so creative.
He's a genius. He's an absolute genius. He's a classically trained prodigy at piano from a young age. He's a genius in the studio, I think, on the level of like Dr. Dre. Like, 100%. These guys are working on a different level. And you're right. I mean, Manson's more of like, he was a performance artist back in the day. Mm-hmm. If you've never seen him live, especially back in the day, his live shows were really phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Yep, seen them all.
Nine Inch is still great live.
I'm 44. I've seen them all. Don't
Heck yeah. So yeah, I always like, I'm prefacing, I'm like, I'm old too. Yeah, I'm 41. So it's like,
Remember the first time I saw Nine Inch Nails at the first Lollapalooza when they came to Toronto.
No, you saw that? I'm so jealous.
Yeah, yeah. We can go on about that.
Yeah.
But that's off topic. All right, let's do a little Halloween-y fun stuff here. So Jess, as we just talked about, you are a huge fan of the villains. Who's your favorite? Do you have a favorite Disney villain?
Ooh,
like in the traditional Disney sense too. Like don't say Darth Vader. Give me somebody from the Disney, you know, the villain series or Jennifer's Disney Chill series.
Yeah, you know, that's a real tough one. But when we were just talking about movies and about, you know, Steve, you sort of foreshadowed a Disney film being really scary. One that popped into my mind was my favorite Disney movie, which is Sleeping Beauty. Mm-hmm. And Maleficent, at the end, when, you know, Aurora is hypnotized and she's about to follow, you know, Maleficent's spell up to the tower and prick her finger on the spinning wheel, on the spindle, this music plays. And it's this, you know, she's in a trance and all the color scheme of the animation goes into like these greens and yellows, and the fact that it's sort of drawn out while the three fairies are trying to look for Aurora is terrifying. And that just reminded me of that. So I'm going to say Maleficent.
Okay. That's a good, great answer. Great answer.
Yeah, I mean, she's great. I'm so with you. That was my favorite growing up too. And I love how the palette of the film is very much like medieval tapestries, and the music in it is just so phenomenal. I used to watch that. We had the VHS. I'd watch it over and over and over.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, the Ivan Dermal artistry in that is, you know, something that I don't think has been, you know, was done previously or has been done since. And I think it's one of those films that really came into its own over time, because given its massive, you know, $6 million budget at the time, it didn't really meet Disney standards then, but, you know, it's almost kind of got this sheen of a cult classic, which is really fun for those of us who are big fans.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I feel the same way about Fantasia, which was definitely more experimental and artistic if you look back at what they did in Fantasia.
And Night on Bull Mountain is a great example of something that was also terrifying.
Yes, it was scary. Like, Fantasia was creepy because it also didn't follow a traditional story structure. And I think sometimes when you break that, you kind of, anything could happen. And that's actually scarier than when you know you're in a traditional narrative and you know you're going to get your prince saving, you know, the princess at the end.
Right. And when things aren't like necessarily linear and you can't make sense of them, it was one of those things when I was growing up, and even now when I'm talking about something scary, if someone doesn't know what I'm talking about and it just sort of comes out as rambling, it's even scarier because it's like you can't like relate to people like what you're trying to say. You know, it's like Fantasia, it's like, you know, there were these like, you know, broken mops, and like then they kind of corrected themselves and Mickey was like lost control of them, and you know, it just sort of sounds like
that really upset me as a child. It's very upsetting because it's like this OCD thing, and when they keep multiplying, it's like gremlins. It's really upsetting because you're like, you know, yeah, it actually really bothered me. Like, I was really worried about Mickey.
That's so funny. I think my favorite, this character didn't scare me the most. That will be part of the movie I pick, but I think my favorite character was Lady Tremaine.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Is
she cold? Ooh.
Oh, like, I mean, like, you just think about sort of like, if you can put like a real world spin on that whole scene, you're just like, my God, she'd be in prison for the rest of her life. Stuff she pulled was insane to me. So I always, I don't know, for some reason, she's like the one I want to like run away from the most. I don't know what she scares the shit out of me, but
I totally see where you're coming from. And I think as I got older, like, she scared me more because I think something translates on film, maybe even a bit sort of away from Disney Cinderella, but in other Cinderella adaptations, like, you know, Cinderella just wants Lady Tremaine to love her, you know, love her as a daughter so desperately, and you know, she doesn't really have anyone else in the world except this, you know, this one woman who despises her. And yeah, there's something so hopeless about that situation that makes it really scary.
And that, you know, she's trapped, and you know, these are her guardians essentially, you know, and she's at their mercy. Yeah, in terms of actually writing the villains, I would say Ursula was really fun. Most of them are really fun. The one I just said, so fun. The one that was not fun for me actually was Cruella de Vil. She was not fun for me. She is a little too dark and terrible even for me. Like, that was what was interesting. I mean, yeah, she's fun in certain characteristics, and I think the book is really fantastic, but I was like, everyone's freaking out about John Wick. He killed one puppy. Like, she wants to kill 101 puppies to make a coat. She's basically the worst person who has ever lived. She's the worst person in the world. Of course, Disney very much wants me to tell you that no puppies were harmed in the making
of
my book.
Of course,
no puppies were harmed in the making of my book. But, you know, but that is the legacy of 101 Dalmatians. You can't get away from it. It's in the title, and the coat is iconic to Cruella. She's pretty terrible because even her motivation, which is what, to look fashionable, is pretty horrifying. Whereas we could go through other characters' motivations, like Ursula. I mean, to a degree, she's like a sea witch. She's entertaining. Like, she's protecting the ocean and her realm. Like, you know,
nothing wrong with that. There's nothing
wrong
with that.
She's not just trying to murder goldfish or something. I don't know.
She strikes a deal. She gives you the choice. So, you know, it's on you to not accept her offer if you're worried about it.
That's right. It's the same with the Shadow Man, right?
Right. That's it. Yeah, you're right. It's like, it's the bargains you make, right? It's, again, it's all about choice. But
look at us here. We're just victim blaming. This is terrible.
It is terrible.
Yeah, you could totally turn it, which Serena obviously tells their stories. And then Captain Hook isn't even really a villain at all, I have concluded.
We'll find more about that if you don't want to spoil that one. That book hasn't come out yet, but that's...
No, Peter Pan's a jerk.
When is that? January 5th. The second Star of the Fright comes out, so everyone keep
an eye on that. Yeah, that, I love that book. That book is really fantastic.
Jess, is there anything that scares you in real life? And I don't mean like the world ending or anything like that. I mean, like,
I mean, 2020 scripted by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. No. I none of the bigger, you know, sort of life things, but you know, spiders or clowns or, you know, do you have any phobias or?
I mean, I was brought up in a really religious family. I'm still practicing Catholic, to some extent. I'm probably not as good as I should be, but so for that reason, all of the films about, like possession and demons and all those kinds of things.
Do you like the Conjuring series?
I love the Conjuring.
I do too. That's my old studio, New Line Excess. But yeah, I the fact that that's like real, like the Warrens were real people.
Yeah.
That's just it. And I love Vera, like full shout out to Vera Farmiga.
Oh, she's amazing.
One of my favorite actresses. She's just fabulous. Loved her in Bates Motel as well. But anyway, sorry, I'm getting off topic. But love the Conjuring series. And I think, I don't know, I was talking to my cousins about this and I was like, why are we so scared of like these movies when some people like it doesn't affect them? And I mean, I'm a big horror movie fan too. It's that adrenaline rush that you were talking about, Jennifer. Like you just get excited. Like you're so you're just excited.
Does this factor in then to your three scary films that I asked you to bring or?
Yeah,
it does. All right, let's hear them. Like give us your three.
Okay, so I think in no particular order.
Right.
I'm going to say the first one is Ouija, Origin of Evil, which is currently on Netflix.
Yep.
Which is also really good, and it was a random movie that I was like, oh, let's just see what, if this is any good. Terrifying. Another one is The Ring, because I watched that in a cinema.
Oh, yeah.
13 years old, and I thought I needed counseling because I was going to die in 7 days, obviously.
I had the same thought because I'm like, if you watch the movie, you see the video.
That's
so
right.
If you saw the video. No, I went home and covered all of my televisions. The Ring actually did. And I don't even like rewatching it because I usually love rewatching horror movies. I like, that one's too scary even for me. It's not pleasant to rewatch.
Right. And even just there's a scene, like, I think it's in the beginning. And that's the other thing about movies, because she was like, we're going to talk about scary movies. And I was like, I'm going to tell you that I'm scared of them, but I'm not sure if I'll be able to articulate why, because my brain just can't kind of deal with them after the fact. They just kind of become a jumble.
One I was so chill with until she came out of the television, and then that was it. Like, I was like, this isn't that bad. And then that hit. And the original Ringu is great. I actually worked with the director who did that on a different project at New Line later on. And I think the original Japanese ones are even scarier.
The Grudge is in a similar thing as
right.
well. That was sort of equally.
All the J-horror.
But here's the thing, though, too. To that point, Jess is like, and Jennifer, you'll understand this more than any three of the three of us. They don't want you to understand why you're afraid, right? That's why they use things like infrasound and those horror frequencies, they call them, that just sort of like have a chemical reaction to you, but you don't know why because you can barely hear it.
Oh, we know why. We craft the movies. I mean, I've worked on a lot of horror. We craft them. I mean, The Ring.
No, you know, you guys know them.
Oh,
the audience. Yeah.
I mean, The Ring is a Pandora's box story. It's Pandora's box. Like, don't watch.
Right.
Don't watch the video,
right?
And then you watch it.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's the fear of the unknown, right? Because I mean, if you wouldn't. There'd be no jump scares if somebody came out a few minutes ahead of each jump scare, and this is the thing. When Jess said, I don't know why it scares me. That means they got you.
Well, there's different types of scares. Like, we
of
talk
course.
About this,
yeah.
And there's beats to a scare. I mean, later we do this, but a horror movie and a comedy movie are the same, except just it's either funny or scary. So in each interval, you need to have a scare or a laugh, like, all the time. So we're always crafting. And I do this even on every Disney Channel, crafting to the scare, crafting to the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And there's usually a couple, like, Mr. X before you hit it. Yeah, there's ways to learn about it. I find it really fascinating. And there's different types of, horror. I find some that are more pervasive where it just kind of sits in this moody. The Ring really sits in a mood.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really break. It's relentless. It's relentlessly terrifying.
All right, Jennifer, give me three scary.
Well, you made me think of one that I hadn't in a while, so I'm going to throw it in there because this movie absolutely terrified me as a child, like, so bad, was Disney's The Black Hole. Have you guys seen this?
Oh, yeah, many times, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It's actually the first movie I watched when I got Disney Plus.
Oh, yes, I would love to remake it or rewrite it because I think it's so great, but I love that Disney, it was a commercial failure for them and it was expensive. I love that they thought they were making Star Wars. Yeah. Like, Disney thought they were making Star Wars. And if you watch Disney's The Black Hole, you'll see why I'm so confused as to why they would think that was Star Wars. Because it's so terrifying. Like, Maximilian, that robot.
Yep.
And where you find out the crew are, like, all wedged inside the robots. And where he, like, has his spinning hands and he like kills that dude, and then the end where they go into the black hole and everything burns, and then where are they, in hell? What's going on? I think space stuff's really scary. I'm obsessed with Event Horizon, and Alien are definitely in these veins, you know. I thought Alien had the greatest tagline ever, which is, in space no one can hear you scream.
Alien is in my top three I'm about to talk about.
Yeah, Alien is like, yeah, I mean, you should. Like, Alien, I mean, it's a work of art. The first three films in particular are, and, you know, it really is a horror movie first and a sci-fi movie second. But yeah, Disney's The Black Hole is the one that I kind of shifted to. I was like, God, I had nightmares about that. My scariest favorite real horror films of all time are Hellraiser. I love Hellraiser. I'm a huge nerd for Hellraiser. I love Clive Barker. I think he's a genius. He did write and direct the first film, which was this little million-dollar movie that the makeup and effects in it are so transgressive. The story is so transgressive. And I love his writing. He wrote Books of Blood, Volume 1 and 2. A lot of his stuff, like Candyman, I also love Candyman, have been made into movies that really stand. I love Hellbound, which is the second Hellraiser, which it just goes so crazy and over the top. But for me, Clive Barker stuff doesn't feel safe. Like, I can read Stephen King pretty much till the cows come home and I'm fine. Maybe It is the one that really gets me. I cannot read Clive without, like, not sleeping for a week. Like, Hellbound Heart, which Hellraiser is based on, it's a little novella. It's this little twisted love story novella. It's not even really about hell at all. And, like, I'll read that and not sleep for a couple days because it just gets under my skin in a way that I can't articulate. So Hellraiser, I love Pinhead.
I was just going to say, and talk about branding. I mean, Pinhead's like an all time, you know, everyone knows Pinhead.
Yeah, and Doug Bradley is great as him, but it wasn't intended. The Cenobites have no names in the novella. They're not named. And it's actually, it was a crew member on set started calling him Pinhead. So it really isn't even in the movie, the whole Pinhead thing. And the Cenobites only come in at the end, actually. It's really not about them.
Right.
But it ended up being the thing that stood out from Hellraiser, like you're saying. And obviously the makeup they did with Pinhead was so iconic. And then he obviously carries the series. But the Scarlet Gospels finally came out a number of years ago, which was the first time Clive revisited the Hellraiser universe. And basically Pinhead gets a point of view in that. And essentially, if you want to die, call him Pinhead. He does not like being called Pinhead. It's not his name.
He's like
the Prince of Darkness or whatever. Right. If you want to die, call him Pinhead. He hates that anyone calls him that, which I thought was very meta and hilarious that he actually wrote it in. So I love the Hellraiser universe and all Clive Barker. And then my favorite movie of all time, not just my favorite horror movie, is The Shining, which I think is a perfect film. I love the book too. I loved Dr. Sleep. Stephen King is wrong about this movie. It is an absolute masterpiece. Kubrick is a master. And Jack Nicholson's performance, everyone talks about Joaquin Phoenix and the Joker and this and that. I'm like, the best Descent into Madness performance, which is really what a Joker story is, isn't even in a Joker movie. It's in The Shining. Jack Nicholson's Descent into Madness performance is the single best one I've ever seen, aside from maybe Gina Rowland's in A Woman Under the Influence. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reason why Jack then ultimately was cast as the Joker later, because no one does it better.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Those are all awesome, great picks. So for me, most of these just go back so long too. It just scared me as a kid. But for me, okay, so Cat's already in the bag on Alien. Alien's in my top three scariest movies that I've ever seen. I remember when I saw it as a kid. Oof. I remember my brother and I were going to go see Aliens in the theater.
Yes.
And my dad's like, nope, not before you see Alien. So he made us watch Alien first. And it scared the shit out of us. We were so scared we didn't even go see Aliens for like a couple weeks.
Well, you know that thing where the alien pops out of the stomach, like, you know, they didn't tell the actors what was going to happen.
I know. I've seen the Origins documentaries, which is fantastic, and they break that scene down just about every way you can, and they talk about that, how especially the woman, I can't remember her name. What's her actress?
Yeah, she's great. She's done a lot of stuff.
Like when she falls off the bench, that was real because she was so scared and shocked by what happened because they didn't tell her.
No, it's so good.
Origins, the documentary on the making of Alien, I recommend it 100%.
I agree. There's just so much to it, even just the production design and everything they were doing.
And then just the mythology behind it is incredible. For me, for whatever reason, when I was a kid, it was all about werewolves. So Silver Bullets and American Werewolf in London.
I was going to ask about American Werewolf. Yeah, yeah. Well, again, makeup and effects.
Scared the crap out of me. And I know Silver Bullet is like its lesser cousin, but that book, The Season of the Wolf, I think it was called, Stephen King was, you know, I remember reading that as a kid, and that scared me. Just the book scared me. But those two werewolf movies scared the crap out of me. And for the Disney one, this movie, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, The Headless Horseman, that the Ichabod Crane, you know, the whole, especially the sequence, of course, that everyone knows about, the panic, you know, as he's making his way to the bridge and the covered bridge, and oh my god, that movie scared me when I was a kid.
I believe The Headless Horseman is terrifying. Like, so who even is he? What's even
the
going
animation
on?
Is amazing. It's just the tension is great. The anxiety, oh god, I'm getting.
I always forget about that one.
I'm getting anxious just thinking about it. Anyways, those sort of three are so great for me.
Well, I had the Disney Channel as a kid, and like honestly, so many things on there scared me so bad. I had a real problem with Hansel and Gretel, like the witch and Hansel and Gretel really upsets
me. That's super creepy if you think about it. Like again, in a real world sort of terms, it's like frightening, right? So.
You guys both brought up really good points, though. You were talking about books as well as films, whether they're adapted or not. I don't know if you guys agree with this, but I feel like books can sometimes be like a hell of a lot scarier because
way scarier.
What's going on in your head? You know, like you're making it up, and it's sort of like this, sort of intimate, lonely experience that no one else is, you know, with. Like it's this journey that no one's with you on, and that is also terrifying in itself.
Jess, I am so with you on that because that's why when I call out Hellraiser and, you know, I have people say, oh, it's not that bad. I'm like, honestly, read Clive Barker because, like, you think I'm kidding. Like, I can't even read the Damnation Game. The first novel, he made it on short stories first. And the first novel he wrote was Damnation Game, which was like a number one bestselling book. And I remember when I was a kid, it was Stephen King. It was a blurb from King said something like, horror has a new name and it is Clive Barker. Something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, if Stephen King is saying this dude must be really scary, right? Mm-hmm. Stephen King's calling him out. And I tried to read Damnation Game. I've tried many times and I get about 130 pages into the book and I'm great. And there's one scene that's just a couple pages long that just messes me up so bad I can't finish the book. Mm-hmm. And that's like power. Like that's such power that he could do that.
There's, you know, a good book that came out this year, The Year of the Witching by Alexis Henderson.
I read about that.
That is so great. It's talk about like scary reading a book. That one gets under your skin, sticks with you for a couple of days. It's one of those books you read and you're like a week later, you're still like,
No, I know what you mean. I also love Joe Hill, who's Stephen King's son. And I remember I read his first book, which is called Heart-Shaped Box. And before anyone knew, he was Stephen King's son because he intentionally published not using his dad's name. Uh-huh. And I remember when I found out, I was like, this dude is as creepy as his dad. And he's a great writer. I love Nosferatu, which is the license plate book, I call it. With this Christmas land thing and this guy who like kidnaps children and takes them to Christmas land. It's just so scary. And I think it was supposed to be a TV show or something, but yeah, I think Jess, I think you're right. Cause I also love the Grimm fairy tales as a kid. I'd read them cover to cover. And a lot of the source material for these films was not in the case of Alien, but a lot of these, what their books and the books I think deliver a certain amount of mythology and development that you're not going to get otherwise. And so there's a depth, even something like The Ring, there was source material cause it was it was a book actually. I believe The Ring was a book. But it was definitely a film in Japan. So yeah.
Yeah, I think, and yeah, there's just something to be said for like shared fear, you know, like you're in a cinema or you're in front of a screen and you're sitting with someone and you're watching it and it's like, oh my God. And then this happened and you're like sharing this experience. But in a book, even if people have read the same book, it's just something that's much more internal. And I think it's damaging in only a good way.
Well, there's the safety in numbers premise, right? I mean, you know, what could go wrong in a theater surrounded by people, right? Yeah.
I totally agree with that. And I think your imagination is so powerful. That's why I think Seven, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Again, Nine Inch Nails, they use the music for that because it's Fincher. But the thing that I thought was great about Seven that made it absolutely one of the most scary films anyone's ever made is that they only show you the aftermath of the crime scene. So then you have to reconstruct in your head what actually happened. And I think that's much scarier than if you saw the murders.
Yes, I totally agree.
Because it's in your head, right? Mm-hmm. That you're imagining this.
Yeah, no, that film was excellent too. Very, very well done.
That film scared the crap out of me in the theaters. My girlfriends and I had to sneak in because it was like R-rated. And I remember we thought it was just like a Brad Pitt cop movie. We're like, let's go see the new, because they wouldn't tell you things back then. You didn't know anything like opening night before the movie. And there were just these teasers on TV that didn't show anything. I was like, let's go see that fun Brad Pitt cop movie. And then I remember in the beginning, we were like, what the fuck is this movie? Like, what is this?
I can't even watch the air freshener scene because that scene,
he coughs.
The line that from the doctor too about he's experienced about as much pain as any, I was, oh God, I can't even watch that scene.
I think that got everyone. I remember at a certain point in that movie, yeah. I was just counting down, okay, so there's seven of these, so I only have to sit through three more of them at this point. And then we talk about Kevin Spacey and all of this, but he plays very dark characters, and I don't know that anyone else would have pulled that off. It's a strange structure to the film because he shows up so late in the movie that if he had been anything disappointing, the movie would have crumbled.
It hinges on that. No, the whole thing.
But he's so terrifying as the everyman. There's a good story actually about the making of that, because that's a New Line movie when Mike DeLuca was the head of the studio, and they sent the script to Fincher, and he loved it and called and was like, you know, I want to do this. He's like, especially love the ending with the head in the box. And they go, what ending? No head in the box. That's the wrong draft. So they apparently sent Fincher the original spec script draft, and they had developed it and totally changed the ending. And so accidentally the assistant had sent the wrong draft to Fincher, which was the original spec script. But he said, I'm only directing it if I get to do this ending.
Nice. That's a good story.
Oh, wow.
That is
a great ending.
There's a great, William Shatner was hosting like the MTV Movie Awards or something. This is years ago. And you know, like with the intros, they like to sort of like, we'll do a take on the popular movies from that year. And then Shatner, they recreated the head in the box scene. But Shatner's playing all the parts. Imagine, you know, Shatner, and he doesn't act. He's just Bill Shatner. He's his own character now, right? But imagine him, you know, gun out. You know, what's in the fucking box? Like,
oh my God.
If you could find it on YouTube, I recommend it. But it's really funny.
I love Shatner. I'm a huge Star Trek nerd. I'm more into TNG, but yeah, Shatner is awesome.
I've kept you way too long, Jennifer. This was such a great conversation.
Y'all are so fun to talk to. It's dangerous.
I'm starting to get the sense we could probably go all night, but
we'll have to do a part two at some point.
Well, how about we have you back in the new year, because January 5th, part three, are we calling it book three?
Disney Chills book three. I mean, they're all standalone situations, but yeah. Yep.
So second start of the fright, featuring everyone's the good guy hero, Captain Hook.
Yes.
It comes out January 5th. Be careful what you wish for. When does that come out? That's next.
I think it's in April. Yeah, April. And then book five is in the summer. So we've done a pretty accelerated release schedule. Sure. And I think there's going to be a really fun marketing push next summer on these books, which it's really fun seeing all the covers together and seeing the series kind of have this cohesiveness. That's just, you know, when you're working in the trenches and you kind of come up for air and you start to see it. It's fun. It's a neat experience. I'm really proud of the books.
It screams box set too, right? So, I mean, it's going to be.
Yeah. I think that's on the radar. That would be so fun. Yeah. Box set, like, you know, for Target or whoever would be awesome.
Jess, any closing words?
Oh, thank you so much. This has been so fun. I didn't even realize how much time had passed until I looked
down. Same.
at the clock, but no, this has been great. And yeah, congratulations, Jennifer. I'm glad to hear you say that you sometimes come up for air, because you've done a lot of great work.
Not very often, but occasionally. Yeah, I'm like, wow, I have 4 books out next year. Look at that.
Yeah, well, I know we were chatting about the covers from the UK and the front and from France, and they're fabulous, and it's really rewarding to kind of sit back and be like, I wrote that. Like, this is great.
It's a weird out-of-body experience. I'll say that. It's a very, you're like, wow, okay. But like I said, and that was when we were speaking about Harry Potter, like once they leave you, they kind of go out, and it is this interesting thing, you know? Mm-hmm. They almost don't belong to you, but it's neat.
I'm just going to say it too. A lot of the times the UK has the better covers. I'm sorry. It's just the way it is. But
sometimes the foreign editions, I think we're going to be out in Japan, and I'm kind of excited if we are to see what that would be. I love the French art. I mean, I think that he's such a wonderful artist, and it's just neat seeing all the different takes. I love the American covers too.
They're great. You know? They're great. Yep.
But sometimes I can't tell if it's just they feel fresher because they're newer too. Then I'm like,
maybe, that's it. Listen, Jennifer, you're in California, you're in Malibu. There's nothing great going on in California between the wildfires and the pandemic. So please, I hope you're safe. I hope your family and friends are safe. And I hope you all continue to be safe. And I hope this fall finds you well and happy and healthy, regardless of the results of what's happening in a couple of weeks.
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. I won't say anything else.
Let's hope. Yeah, no, we won't need to bring it up. But yes, continued health and happiness. It sounds like your career is really rocking. I can't wait to check back with you next year and get some more updates. And happy Halloween. I don't know what anyone's doing for Halloween this year.
Everyone's so skittish about it.
But whatever.
Watching scary movies at home on Netflix. I got to watch Ouija.
We just gave you like 100 awesome movies to watch.
Oh, so. I'm so watching Ouija. Thanks, Jeff. I can't wait.
So whatever everybody does for Halloween, please be safe. And
read Disney Chills.
Read Disney Chills. The two, I'm holding the two in my hand.
It's very right pandemic safe. Reading books is very safe activity.
they're fun reads for, and Jennifer, I think you really hit the nail on the head too. These are really great, not just for kids. These are fun. I read them. I enjoyed the heck out of them. These are great for adults too. So
thanks for saying that. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. You're awesome.
All right, Jennifer, thanks again. Jess, thanks again. And everybody else, please be safe, and we will talk to everybody real soon.